alayhi salam, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, at the time of his occultation, and those who are going to be waiting for the advent of Imam actually is the military preparation. One of the basic instructions of Quran and Islam is to the Muslims, actually, is to maintain the full readiness against the enemies. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also wants us to work on the training of our human resources, manpower, and also proper preparation to help the right front against the wrong.
True.
This is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and also the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt all in all actually guide us towards that. Be helpful to an oppressed and be an enemy to the oppressor.
Yeah. So
this is again what we have received from the words of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam.
True.
So we need to prepare ourselves. Why? Because we are going to follow the most hugest revolution in the world at the time of Imam. How can we go and help this noble Imam without having such preparations?
True.
Some people say that, okay, an Islamic Ummah should be only waiting and should just focus on dua's application and just wait for the Imam. No, it's not true. Because in Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in chapter of Anfal, verse 60, prepare against them what you believers can of military power and cleverly to deter Allah's enemies and your enemies, as well as other enemies unknown to you. So Allah wants us to prepare ourselves to the level, to the utmost level that we can. So Allah doesn't want us to stay somewhere and just
be limited
to du'as and prayers and salat and namaz.
True.
No, Allah wants us to do something, to prepare ourselves.
True.
You know, so we should not be indifferent towards our preparations. And as you see, the Islamic Ummah tries to prepare itself. And we see in our country here that when some people even objected the leader of the Islamic Ummah that this world, there is no more need for the equipment, I mean, military equipment, the leader said, no, this is Quranic teaching that we are following.
True.
Allah wants us to be strong, to make whatever we can for defending the Islamic Ummah and nation.
True.
One might say, okay, this is the duty of the military people. And what's that to me as an
ordinary
people? I'm a scholar. I'm, let's say, a university student.
Yeah.
Look, all of these issues are connected and interconnected to each other. When you are a university student or, let's say, your scholar, the outcome of your thoughts, the outcome of your studies will reach to that military equipment.
Yeah.
When you are a scholar, Islamic scholar, then a person who is a military knows what is his duty. Then
when he
knows his duty, he acts upon it. A part of it is actually a part of theory and theoretical aspect of it, and then a part of it is a practical aspect of it.
True.
When we have not yet worked on the theoretical aspect of it enough, then the practical aspect will be damaged and will not show itself in the level that it should be.
Hold me by your hand and please show me the way to be one of the pure and chosen companions, so that I can swear the oath of allegiance. I'll give everything that I love in God's name to avenge the blood of your grandfather Hussein. Every step of the way, my dream will come true. On my last breath, oh Master, I'll call out to you. O Light of Allah, you are my true guide. I'm waiting for you to die by your side.
You have reminded me of something very beautiful talking with your discussion. You basically said that first, before this military preparation, you said that rich have to help poor.
Mm-hmm.
And as an Islamic nation, as Islamic people, we have to work on Quran, which says that to the utmost of your
readiness.
You know, prepare yourself,
mm-hmm.
be ready for the defense. You reminded me of this verse which says, while al-musallin may help. Hell with these who pray. And then when we contemplate on the verse, we say, oh my God, praying is obligatory. And Allah is saying, hell with those who pray. But then we say verses before and behind this verse, they say that you pray and at the same time you do not help the orphans.
Mm-hmm.
You do not take care of the orphans.
Very true.
So we are seeing Muslim countries around us who are bombing and making people orphan, making you know, the children orphan. And we are seeing at the same time the Muslim countries who pray and they take the aid. to these countries. You rightly mentioned that they do have equipments and that readiness, but they have reached a wrong conclusion.
Mm-hmm. The problem is actually in the theoretical aspect of it.
True.
Because it has not been yet strengthened in the level that it has to be.
It has to be.
Look, you said that some of them are equipped even with the military equipments. I want to say even that part of it has not been achieved yet. So we want to say that all the Muslims are actually, all those who are going to be waiters of the Imam, they have their own duties, theoretical aspect of it. They have to help the Islamic Ummah to prepare himself militarily. You might say, okay, I'm a simple worker. So what's my role? Then when you know that this is the right thing, you have understood it, and you need to tell those who have not yet understood this point that this is a duty for a duty bound in the time of ghaib and occultation of the Imam. So you have performed your duty.
True.
So it can be related in such a way to that. We said that this readiness actually has two aspects or two parts. One is military and second is media readiness. Media readiness, because at the time of arrival and advent of Imam, we have lots of hadith that they say that it is very difficult for people to keep up with their imans, with their beliefs.
Faith, yeah.
And faith. Let's dissect that. What is the reason that people will face the problem with that? And what is going to affect them that they might not be able to find the right way?
True.
So this is the power of the media. The effect of the media is not less than the effect of the war. Even sometimes more. And the leader of the Islamic Ummah a couple of times actually referred to that. Cultural attack is more heavier than the military attack.
The physical military attack.
Because
yeah.
they have actually changed your mind in the way that they want.
The public opinion.
Very true.
Yeah. Using the media techniques.
Media techniques and changing the realities. They change the place of a martyr with the place of, let's say, oppressor.
Yeah.
See? And they said that when, for example, suppose, God forbid, when we change the place of, we take refuge to Allah, Imam Hussein and Yazid. So you know that the Yazid was an oppressed one and Imam Hussein was an oppressor. So you know what happens then? The realities change.
The story, yeah.
So this is the power of the media. Then what happens? The Muslims who have to be in the army of the Imam will be placed in the army of the enemy. This enlightenment is needed.
True.
I have seen in some hadith, and I want to talk about the theme of such a hadith, that this is one of the most important duties of the Muslim at the time of occultation of Imam. That is media readiness.
Media readiness.
Yeah. Every single person should be a media. What is the reason? We have heard that at the time of advent of Imam, the people are equipped with the highest and the newest and the highest technology of, let's say, weapons. So what comes that media is more important than that? As we see today. You see, the concept of terrorist is changing. Media emperor. That they are working on the minds of the people. In an ugly way, they are changing the realities. They, for example, when it comes to the people of Palestine, or when it comes to the people of Yemen, or Syrian people, they say, okay, they are not white people and blonde and, let's say, blue-eyed people. They are ordinary people. So they deserve to be killed. But there, in the West, those people are not deserved to be killed.
True.
You see, these double standards, these ugly double standards that we see from international legitimacy is really something that has appeared from the power of the media.
Power of media, true.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
So every single Muslim, everyone who is waiting for the Imam to come, his duty is to be a media for Imam Ali.
All right.
From his pen, from his mouth, from his, let's say, works and literature, from whatever he actually is producing this work.
So we reach a point that person in media readiness, a person not only needs to be media himself, but he has to have that knowledge of media, not mm-hmm. to accept everything what is coming in.
This is called media literacy or digital.
Media literacy, yeah.
Media literacy should be actually encouraged among the people. We have
exactly.
to inform our people. We have to tell them whatever is received, whatever is come to us,
has come to us is not true. As soon as a clip is received, it is forwarded like a mm-hmm. jungle fire.
It becomes viral among the people.
Yeah.
So we have to know whatever we receive is not necessarily true.
Yeah.
What we receive is not necessarily right.
Even forwarding a message, mm-hmm. I must see what I am forwarding. Is that true? How true is that?
We have to be very careful here in these cases and
true.
Issues. We have to be really, really watchful of what we are forwarding to others to know that whatever we are actually sending to other people, does it have any reality or not? As you said, we should.
Otherwise, you're responsible. Like, you'll be asked tomorrow, how did you forward something that was fake? Or, like, why didn't you research on it?
Very true. Very true. Yeah. We know that the revolution of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam at the end will end and will lead to the government of the mustad'afin, the government of the poor and the elite and those who deserve to be the rulers of the world. So this government needs to be helped. So how this help is going to be manifested? By our help. And we have our preparations. And our having the, as I said, this military preparation, this media preparation, media literacy, with strengthening ourselves in different aspects. Look, one more example of media literacy I want to mention, and then inshallah we move to the next point. Look at the time that Prophet Musa alayhi salam left his nation and went to the mountain of Tur. How long did it take? 30 days, then added 10 more days, it became 40 days. But what happened when he came back? He said that he saw that somebody changed everything. This is the power of media. Somebody was a media there.
Yeah.
Actually, he acted like a media. At that time, there was no newspaper, there was no mobile, there was no application to...
We have seen the power of media in Lady Zainab itself.
Mm,
like, she changed
exactly.
with her speech, she changed the arrows, she changes the smiling faces into tears.
Mm-hmm.
She broke the pride. In fact, it's that we have that Persian couplet that says, Karbala dar Karbala mimand agar Zainab nabud. If Zainab was not there, Karbala would have remained in Karbala, would have never got to know about it. So we have seen, like, even if when there was in that desert, how Zainab salamullahi alayha acted as a media. Dr. Alavi, I'll be talking to you about all these points and the next points, inshallah, in the next session. For now, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you, dear listeners. You were listening to the IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
on the news line.
With the conflict between Russia and Ukraine ongoing for over 3 weeks, Turkey is playing a significant role to de-escalate the tensions. The country is hosting high-level discussions between the two sides aimed at reaching a ceasefire, expressing readiness to host talks between the presidents of Ukraine and Russia. In the meantime, reports suggest that the United States has informally suggested that Turkey send its Russian-made S-400 missile defense systems to Ukraine to help Kiev with its fight against Russian forces. The report suggests that American officials have floated the idea with their Turkish counterparts, but no formal request was made. The idea was also mentioned during Deputy State Secretary Wendy Sherman's visit to Turkey earlier this month. That seems too convenient for the U.S. and its Western allies that have been asking Turkey to abandon its Russian-made air defenses and instead use American-made Patriot counterparts.
Yes, it's exactly the same system that they complained about earlier, but the political geometry has changed a little bit, so the United States is trying to turn things around to try and bring Turkey closer and to separate it a little more from Russia, and to overcome the debacle for the U.S. that the Turkey's purchase of these missiles created earlier.
Observers say Turkey will almost certainly reject the proposal, but the fact that it's even being offered reveals the West's opportunistic policies. Turkey signed a multi-billion dollar agreement to acquire several batteries of Russia's S-400 missile defense system in 2017. The West wasn't pleased with the deal, arguing that installing such systems in a NATO country would potentially compromise the security of the military alliance, as well as pose a risk to the newly developed F-35 fighter jets. The first batch of the Russian-made system was delivered to Turkey in 2019, enraging the West. Former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions on Turkey over the incident and cut Ankara, a financial and manufacturing partner, from the F-35 program. Turkey has demanded repayment of some $1.4 billion it put into the program, but so far hasn't received anything back. Turkey stresses that it opted for the Russian system as the Western-made counterparts were not offered to it at agreeable terms. The U.S. suggestion that Ankara send its S-400 missile defense system to Ukraine to shoot down Russian fighter jets, apart from the technical hurdles of delivering and installing them, would potentially risk a Russian blowback. Washington has certainly predicted that any deterioration of ties between Ankara and Moscow could harm Turkey's position as a neutral broker and derail the ceasefire talks. That raises some serious questions about the U.S. stated willingness to end the conflict in Ukraine as soon as possible.
The spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari', says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari' noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari' announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayyad, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Dhahran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Sari has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots. But the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several U.S. and NATO officials have also noted that they're not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the U.S. and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions, like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare, or at least posture for the preparing of, further military aid to support, either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as is usually the norm. But data about what the U.S. troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the East, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
U.S. President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the U.S. another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the U.S. and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.
Thank you. Nowruz, happy customs in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Feasts are the common feature of all cultures. Basically, a feast is a ceremony to pray and thank God for a victory or a great social event. Nowruz is an ancient national feast which has remained since thousands of years ago. It is rich in lofty human aspects. During Nowruz, many ceremonies are held throughout Iran. The first day of the solar year in Iran is the Feast of New Iranian Year. But it is not limited to Iran's geographical borders. It is celebrated in the vast area covering the entire regions of the Iranian culture. According to the statistics, at least 12 nations celebrate Nowruz, although each of them starts the feast according to their own national calendar. In addition to the nations within the domain of Nowruz culture, people in many countries celebrate Nowruz unofficially. India, Turkey, Egypt, France, Tatarstan in Russia, the United States, England, Canada, Netherlands, Germany, Lebanon, Syria, China, United Arab Emirates, and Sweden are among these nations. Today we are going to talk about various happy customs in different regions in Iran during Nowruz days. Stay tuned, please. Among the commonest symbols of Nowruz are Haji Firuz and Amu Nowruz. These two itinerant figures go in different neighborhoods of cities and try to make people happy by singing very simple songs as a promise of the arrival of spring and Nowruz. Haji Firuz is a well-known figure in the Iranian folklore. He brings the message of arrival of Nowruz. He is usually a thin man who has blackened his face. He wears cone-shaped cap and red clothes with pointed shoes. Haji Firuz holds a tambourine at hand and playfully sings very simple folkloric songs on Nowruz. Another figure who may be seen on the streets in Iran is Amu Nowruz or Baba Nowruz. This figure comes with Haji Firuz and is the symbol of time. He is an old man with white hair and beard, wearing a blue silk belt, a white shawl, linen trousers, and light flat shoes. According to old tales, he comes from mountains toward cities with a stick in his hand. Amu Nowruz is the husband of Nane Sarma, and these two symbolize the turning of the old day to the new one. According to the old tales, Nane Sarma impatiently waits for the arrival of Amu Nowruz, but she falls asleep and wakes up only to see that Amu Nowruz has come and gone. Thus, she forgets about him till next year. Dear listeners, As I said, there are many ceremonies in different regions of Iran during Nowruz. For example, the people of East Azerbaijan, West Azerbaijan, and Ardabil provinces hold a special ceremony called Tokamchi. Tokam is a wooden effigy of a male goat. Tokamchi is the person who moves the effigy in the air while singing spring songs. According to the ancient Iranian text, goat is the symbol of ascension, solidity, and fertility. A Tokamchi usually comes from the mountain and reads out poems on Nowruz and generation. The traditional saya is another ceremony which is held by Azeri people of Iran. Saya means respect, and it is held a few days before Nowruz. Sayachi is the person who holds the ceremony. He's usually an itinerant artist who wears colorful clothes and goes from village to village and reciting happy poems on spring and Nowruz, gives the tidings of the arrival of Nowruz while beating two wooden sticks in hand. People used to give them wheat, barley, sweets, and money. Iranian Kurds, too, have had ceremonies to mark Nowruz. Mir Nowruzi or Kuse Gardi was among the dramatic arts which used to be held among Kurds. Mir Nowruzi is a comic show in which a person is chosen as the governor or administer the affairs. Villagers would wear farcical masks and see off the main showman, meaning Kuse, and his bride. The Mir Nowruzi group would go from one house to another to give the good tidings of arrival of Nowruz while reciting poems. Usually, they would receive gifts for their performance. The people of Khorasan in eastern and northeastern Iran also hold Mir Nowruzi or Nowruz Khan ceremony in many villages and nomadic regions. Mir Nowruzi is a comic show in which a well-built man with neat clothes is symbolically chosen as the governor. He rides a horse and starts gathering taxes and gifts from villagers. Some people play local instruments and sing folkloric songs to accompany the show. At the end of Nowruz, that is 13th of Farvardin, the villagers play instruments while dropping the governor in a pond. Then they take him out and, while taking off his clothes, cause him to wear simple clothes and tell him that he is no more a Khan. Well, dear listeners, next episode, we will talk about other Nowruz ceremonies in Iran. Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around $14 to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
The discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in the right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others. A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material such as oil paints to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the U.S. 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as sea shells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs. Retired racehorses could be retrained for a new role as so-called therapy horses. According to a study led by the University of Bristol, veterans and disabled children, as well as those struggling with mental health issues, can benefit from the therapy horses. The three-year study aims to provide a global standard for the racing industry and a toolkit for retraining racehorses. A racehorse's career can last anywhere between 2 and 10 years, but better could be done to make use of these beautiful creatures soon after they're retired.
So racehorses, when they finish their racing careers, and they can finish as young as sort of 3 or 4 years old, they really don't want to be just standing around in fields for the next 20, 30 years. And they're so versatile that I really believe there's a job for 99% of them. I think there's almost a sixth sense with the horse. So with people needing therapy, whether that's mental health or physical disabilities, there seems to be sort of something that gels between a horse and a human.
Horse trainers say with the thoroughbred's lifespan between 25 to 30 years, this study's aim is crucial for their long-term welfare. Over 7,000 racehorses end their career every year in Britain, with many going into eventing and pleasure riding. A killer whale beached on a Mexican shore has been rescued by locals and environmentalists. Volunteers with a group called Youth Allied to the Environment helped carry the orca out of the sea. The whale was loaded onto a truck and taken to a large dock for medical examination. Volunteers say locals gathered to form a human chain in an effort to quickly fill the tub with water. The orca is being treated at a marine biology department of the Yucatan Autonomous University. Veterinarians say the whale appeared to have some pulmonary problems and will be released back to the ocean after the recuperation.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
To some people, it is just garbage, but to this Filipino woman, recyclable items have become a source of livelihood as she turns them into beautiful outfits. Leonora Biovaje is an experienced dressmaker who can weave and stitch nearly any type of material together to make fashionable frocks and gowns. She uses newspapers, plastic wrappers, and rice sacks as her clothing materials. She says rice sacks have the advantage of print and patterns, which both bring texture and color to her designs. The seamstress says she often uses packaging and bubble wraps from her children's delivery orders to make her gowns, among other materials.
It's good to use recycled materials because the cost is inexpensive. All you are really paying for is labor. It is durable, colorful, and we can help the environment at the same time.
She says her dresses sell for $30 to $50 and are used in weddings and other debut events. The recycled materials used for each dress would depend on her client's request. Her designs using recycled materials have also caught the attention of local fashion events. Leonora says she hopes to inspire others to create clothing out of ordinary recycled materials.
Okay,
Elephant Day in Thailand. The country celebrates the large animal as a source of national pride and cultural identity throughout its history. One celebration took place in Chonburi province on the eastern Gulf of Thailand coast. Dozens of elephants were hosted at a famous botanical park. The animals were treated to 2 tons of fruits and vegetables laid out on a table as wide as 8 meters. Elephants in the past were used for labor, transport, and in battlefields by warriors and kings. But nowadays, they're no longer used for heavy-duty jobs.
And time have changed. These elephants now, they are no longer used. We have better equipment to carry log and all that. So they become what we call homely elephant. These have been their life. We train them, they rest among us, we give them food. So now they have a homely life. Homely life, we have to support them. So now they go to the tourist attraction place, they're riding elephant, and all this is.
The feast takes place on March 13th every year and commonly in various parts of Thailand. But this year, celebrations were few because of the COVID pandemic and the economic woes that have come with it. Competition at stand-up paddleboard events is fierce, but competing on Europe's biggest underground lake adds another level of difficulty. One such race has been held in Switzerland as part of the 7-stage Alpine Lakes Tour. Some 60 paddlers have competed on the 300-meter-long underground lake on an illuminated course. Organizers named it the Bat Race because it was staged in a cave.
It's a great day because we are on an underground lake, and this only takes place here. There's nothing like this elsewhere, and really the atmosphere is great because we are in the dark. We paddle without knowing where we are going. It's a really fun atmosphere.
Other athletes were excited about the setting, describing it as wonderful and magnificent. They said it was magical to see the trout deep underwater inside the cave. Others said they sometimes struggled to breathe, but all the participants agreed that it was absolutely fun.
Local fishermen have rescued an injured baby manatee on a bay in far southeastern Cuba. The fishermen are nursing the injured baby manatee with cow and goat milk mixed with coconut water. They discovered the injured manatee with gashes on his head and body in Maria del Portillo Bay near Havana. Upon arrival on shore, the fishermen recruited volunteers for a nearby farming village.
We were fishing along the shore when we saw the manatee coming. When it approached us, we realized it was injured. It had several wounds on its body, one on the head and two on the rest of the body. Between the two of us, we made the decision to take her to the port of Maria del Portillo, where the boats were moored. When we got there, the whole town was very surprised. Some people ran to help us, others ran to get milk. Seeing that it was small and knowing that it's a mammal, we decided to give it some milk. The people who have cows gave us cow's milk. Those who have goats gave us goat's milk.
Manatees are aquatic mammals akin to giant water-borne cow. The mammal is found in sheltered bays and estuaries throughout Cuba. Scientists say coastal communities could play a key role in protecting marine species and their habitats.
IRIB English Radio.